broadcasting from the shores of El Pacifico, Bill Hendry.
So when you subtract what was surfed and what's left over, we'll know exactly what they consumed.
One of the things that was, and I had to make my own conclusion on this because they're not really sure.
I think you need to make the parents responsible. You're looking at every other
So app. When you subtract what was surfed...
Burn in hell.
What the hell is that? So when you subtract, then you find out. World famous Phil Hendry Show every night until 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast, a news talk and entertainment show.
So when you subtract...
That knows what it's talking about. We go places other talk shows would love to go, but they can't. So give it up, man. Give it up. We're out on the point. We're leading the way, as we always have done. And let me tell you something. This is a radio show that cannot be contained by the... the radio show paradigm these days. It just isn't going to happen. You know, I really feel sorry for radio listeners these days. I really do. They have expectations that are now limited. The average radio listener has an expectation that only is about so big. And when a radio show like ours comes along, it blows. You know, and you actually get into our show, it just blows their minds. They suddenly have to reevaluate everything they've been listening to. It's the saddest thing to hear people say that what is talk radio? Well, it's about politics. It's the saddest thing in the world. It's the saddest thing because radio is capable of so much more. We do it, and I sure... One thing I ain't going to do is I ain't starting no school, bud, so give it up.
Yeah, but you know, there's all kinds of money you can make doing all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, get out of here. What am I going to do, some correspondence course? I'd rather jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. We were just talking about that.
You're kidding me, man. If you did a online course, you know?
I'm not doing any radio online course. Forget it. You know what? You know who ought to be doing courses in broadcasting are these colleges and universities, the commercial radio, the broadcast schools of most universities. And if you're out there and you're listening to me and you're considering taking broadcasting at a university, don't do it. Don't do it. There's maybe two or three major universities that do it well. And I only know that by word of mouth and reputation. I don't know whether they do or not. I know that Syracuse is very, very well known as a great broadcast school, and Northwestern. That's it. I don't know any others. Maybe Nebraska.
What about California and everything like that?
I ain't heard diddly squat about California. All the really good broadcast schools are out in the middle of nowhere. All right. No, I'm just kidding about that. Nebraska is, though.
That's pretty well. Why Nebraska?
I don't know, man. They got some news anchor school or something. Anyway... Welcome back to the show. Now, it was very interesting because we were talking here. Jay said to me, you know, during the pre-show, and as you know, here on the Phil Hendry Show, we have a live streaming video of the show each and every night. You can watch us on Phil TV in HD as we do our radio show. And I do a pre-show. And tonight I did about an hour of a pre-show. And Jason said, what was the thing you're talking about, To Kill a Mockingbird? Oh, I said, well, there's a story about how these brain surgeon parents in Ohio want To Kill a Mockingbird, the play. They want to kill it because they don't like the use of the N-word in the play. Now, I understand that there are sensitivities, but when you start messing with a classic because you aren't bright enough to understand context, I don't give a damn if you're black or white. When you start doing that, you have officially joined the dumb club. Forget about Kurt Cobain and whether he's in the stupid club or not. I have no idea. But, man, you can still be walking around upright and be in the stupid club. Don't worry about it. And I looked at this and I said, my God, here we go again. The last thing, it was Mark Twain. Now it's To Kill a Mockingbird. Now it's something else. Now it's this. Now it's that. Now it's something else. I said, where are the people that are going to stand up for sanity? Where are they? I'm not talking about talk show hosts. I've had a belly full of talk show hosts. I'm not talking about movie stars. I'm not talking about politicians. Where are the average people? Where are the parents? Where is the one parent who has the guts to stand up and say, we got to go to the mat for education, not because we think we know what's right, but because we stand behind educators? Where in the hell are the heroes in this world? Why do you think, as I've said so many times, we like the Sullenbergers, we like the SEAL Team 6, we like our soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq? These are the only heroes that I know of. These are the only people that I know of that are putting it on the line. These are the only people that I know of that are doing their job well. I'm being, you know, facetious. I'm not being facetious so much as I'm overgeneralizing for a point. There are a great many people doing their jobs very, very well. There's a lot of heroism in this world. All over the world. But I'm saying, and in this country in particular, but I'm saying the really visible and just the very, very visible kinds of heroisms that we love to talk about when we were younger, or perhaps from history, the people that stand taller than life itself, the big names. Where the hell are they, man? Why has it been over 100 years since we've had a Lincoln? Now, some people might argue that there have been presidents of equal stature since then, but no one's made the case. No one's made the case. So I was talking about the fact that this is a great play. It was a great book. And here's a school, McConnellsville, Ohio, a school, the Morgan Local School District. And Lori Snyder Lowe. And what happened to Lori Snyder Lowe? Well, she got some calls from parents concerned about the play because it has a racial slur, the N-word. Now, these may be black parents, and there may be white parents out there that are saying, oh, that's silly. Why don't they let the play? So I know how it breaks down. Don't worry about it. But then the next week, there's a white parent out there or a group of white parents out there that are getting upset with a play that makes the protagonist or one of the heroes of the book look like a racist, and they don't like that. So there's complaints about that. This play was scheduled to be performed for the students this week, but this woman, Lori Snyder Lowe, who's a superintendent, said she made her decision after calling other school districts and learning they'd not allowed the play at their school either. So a whole bunch of gutless people, I mean, forget about whether they're school superintendents or not, just gutless people have caved in to the stupidity of parents. And parents, more often than not, when it comes to education, ain't got all their oars in the water, man. I'm sorry, but they just don't. I know that there are parents that believe they just got it all figured out. No, you don't. So the secretary for the Zane Trace Players, Bruce Revenaugh, said he was greatly disappointed after he learned he would not be producing the play for the students. The superintendent said we would have to take the word out or we couldn't do it. Don't take the word out. The book, written in 1960 by Harper Lee, is told from the perspective of the character Scout, who grew up in the South, whose father defends a black man at a rape trial. One of the most famous quotes of the book is Scout's father, Atticus, telling her, "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around." Revenaugh said he contacted the publishing company for permission to exchange the word for another, and he was told no. Good for you, publishing company. So the thing that we lack in this society is heroism. If you think it's heroic to go and mess with the words of a classic, to mess with art, to take things out and put things in, if you think that's heroic, no. That's what, quite frankly, that's what fascists do. That's what an overly controlling and constrictive police state does. That's not what educators are supposed to do. You want to take the word out of something? Then you go find the local neighborhood Hitler. Don't go asking a teacher to do that. Go ask the people that burn the books because they don't like what's in them. Go ask the people that burn the books or take the books and throw them in a garbage, those kinds of people, because they don't like what's in the book. Go ask them. They'll take all the words out for you. So,
yeah, but what about the bridge? You said that about heroism.
All right. Well, okay. So that I got into the bridge, and that's probably almost another quarter hour, but there's a movie that really was haunting when I saw it. I heard it talked about, and I went ahead and I watched it. I got the clips and watched this film called The Bridge. And this is a movie. It's the most unusual film I've ever seen in my life. It was a movie shot in 2004. And it was about a record-breaking year for people jumping off the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge. The filmmakers set their cameras up directed at the Golden Gate Bridge, and they caught on film for this movie the suicide of something like 6 or 7 people that I can remember. I mean, right there in color, the film opens up with a suicide, and the film opens in the most haunting fashion because it's a beautiful day. The sun is out. There's people bicycling. There's people walking. There's people that are parasailing. There are guys that are windsurfing down along the waters of the bay. It's a gorgeous day. And as the camera pans along the railing of the Golden Gate Bridge, you see people that are standing there. You see people eating lunch. You see people walking. You see people laughing. Some kids carrying balloons. People riding bicycles. And then you see people standing and looking at. And then you see one man, looks to be in his 60s, wearing a baseball cap, staring down at the water. And he climbs over the railing and dives off the Golden Gate Bridge. Just like that, the camera follows him all the way down to the water, and then the credits roll, and you realize, well, this is a movie that I don't think I should miss, even though I'm sure I'm not going to enjoy it. And the reason why I brought all this stuff up about heroism, you guys, is because of this.
Yeah, you said about that one guy.
All right, well, hold on. So they're interviewing all these people, friends of the people who committed suicide, people who were there, and it's interesting to see, as you are looking at people on this bridge, there's one instance in the film where there's a man staring and staring and staring off the bridge and looking into the water and staring, and the next thing you see, a cop walks up, puts his arm around the guy's shoulder, and walks him away from the edge of the railing. And you suddenly realize, my God, those cops have seen this before. And they walked the guy away from the rail. Somebody had called him in. Maybe it was just a cop driving by. But I thought the most breathtaking thing for me was there was a woman and there was a guy taking pictures. They're not related. They're not together. The guy is taking pictures. It turns out later he's from Boston, and they interviewed him. And he's taking pictures of the bridge, and he's taking pictures of the water. Meanwhile, this woman's standing next to him. She climbs over the railing, and she gets down onto another little level that's just a level below the railing, overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge, doing the same thing she did as she stood street level, staring at the water, staring at the water. The guy's taking these pictures, but gradually he's looking at her, right?
Yeah.
And he says, as they interview him later, he says, well, I saw her, and then he starts taking pictures of her. He says, I kind of saw her. She went over the railing, and I'm wondering what she's doing. I took this one picture of her. She went over the railing. I took another picture of her. She's standing there. And then you see, caught on camera by the filmmakers, this guy put his camera down and with one big arm reaches down, grabs her by her collar, and hauls her, one arm, hauls her right back up onto the street and sits on her until the paramedics get there or the cops get there.
You picked her up with one arm, huh?
Picked her up with one arm, and you could see her sort of squirming to get away from him as she probably was just about to jump into the bloody golden, into the San Francisco Bay. And here is this guy, man, this guardian angel out of nowhere. This guy just reaches down and hauls her right back up onto the street. And hauls her right back up onto the street.
I would have done that.
You think you would have done that. You think you would have done that, man.
Well, I would have said something.
I don't know. Maybe you would have. That guy did. He was taking pictures. He took a picture of her. Then he's looking at her. Then he's looking. He says, Jesus, that woman's going to jump. He reaches down. He grabs her. He pulls her up off of the bridge. So, anyway.
Yeah, but you're saying there's all kind of hero and everything. That's one of them.
Well, that's true. That's true. All right. We'll be back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show. Don't watch that movie, though, man. Like I watched it late at night. And it's just, it's the saddest bloody thing you've ever seen in your life. Good God, what made me want to watch that?
Other than Johnny Bean.
Johnny Bean, you did it to me, man. You were talking about it. All right, we'll be right back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show. And don't forget, philhenryshow.com. How easy is it to quit smoking cigarettes, man? I did it. I was a three-pack-a-day smoker. I can tell you this. I quit the hard way. We'll find out. A guy who works for Philip Morris, namely the CEO, says it ain't hard. We'll find out when we come back to the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Radio for patriots, by patriots. It's the Phil Henry Show. Radio for patriots, by patriots. It's the Phil Henry Show.
World-famous Phil Henry Show. Now, this guy, and welcome back here. What do you got, bud?
There's a quote about that guy that jumped off.
Well, there's a bunch of people that jump off in the movie.
No, that one guy, he said it looked like Chris Pelton.
Don't say it. Chris, if you're listening, the one guy that jumped off at the end looked like you. No, he had long black hair. He had a long black beard. He had black sunglasses on. He was wearing all black. He was a very interesting-looking guy, like I was saying. And they show this guy in the movie The Bridge that we were talking about. That is a film tracking the lives of, it's about the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and people that jumped off the bridge, because this year, 2004, was a record-breaking year for people jumping off. And I hate to sound, I hope this doesn't sound bad, but I'm glad they haven't done anything to the Golden Gate Bridge, like put up those anti-jumping spikes.
Yeah, I was going to say that, man. That'll make it look really bad. I mean, how are they figuring to save people?
Well, I guess it would save people, but if the guy's intent on killing himself, I don't know. But they haven't done anything. Watch, now I'm bringing it up. Somebody's bound to do something. You know, they're bound to put, like, what, barbed wire or chicken wire or something. The young man in the film who's sort of tracked throughout the movie by the filmmakers is a guy named Gene Sprague. He's a young guy. He's in his early 30s. And he is spoken of by his friends in this film, as all of the people who are seen committing suicide in this film are spoken of by their friends, and with great love. But you can tell that these people were terribly troubled. This one kid, Gene Sprague, was constantly talking about ending it all, constantly talking about wanting to end it, wanting to end his life. And he went to St. Louis. He met a girl. It didn't work out. He comes back. You know, the guy's whole life is just a drag, you know. Now, on May the 11th, he paced up and down the bridge for roughly 90 minutes, eventually jumping onto the rail and then falling backwards off the bridge. And this is the closing scene of the movie where this guy, Gene Sprague, stands on top of the rail and then almost as if he's bungee jumping. It's just the most bizarre thing you've ever seen. Now, one of the things that the first thing I thought, a lot of people have thought, and the filmmakers address, you got these people on film committing suicide. Why would you stand there with a camera and watch this when you know that they could be stopped? And the Eric Steele, who's the film's director, made a very good point. He said the man walked from the south side to the north side, off the bridge, and then back north to the south, which is typical of what tourists do. He said, I didn't sense he would jump off the bridge, but there must have been something about him that caught our attention. I think that what caught their attention is the fact that he was all in black. He was a very interesting-looking guy. He definitely looked different from anybody else on the bridge that day, even though he didn't really catch the attention of people that walked past. But he's kind of an imposing guy with a black jacket and the black jeans, tall guy, long hair, you know.
Well, he looked like a metalhead.
Yeah, like a headbanger, something like that, you know. So they are following this guy with a camera. They also had their camera on a bunch of other people, and it just so happens that this guy then stands on the railing and falls backward off the bridge. Now, one other thing, they had a camera below bay level, at the level of the San Francisco Bay itself, so they were well below the bridge, and they caught this guy falling from two angles.
Oh, that right there, man, that's a dead giveaway. They didn't know about it.
What do you mean they knew about it, bud? You got to be more specific than that.
Well, why are you going to get two cameras on a guy? You must have known something in advance.
Yeah, maybe they paid him.
Paid him?
Oh, I mean,
what do you mean they paid him? You gonna pay a guy enough money to kill himself? Where's he gonna spend it? See, that's the thing you gotta think about.
Yeah, okay.
Well, you guys are about as stupid a human beings as I ever met in my life.
Why?
Maybe they paid him, and then this guy's gotta explain to you that no, they couldn't have paid him because after he kills himself, he can't spend the money.
Well, that makes sense.
You guys shouldn't even be having that conversation. Maybe they paid him. They had, I'll tell you this much, they had a camera below the bridge, they had a camera that was shooting straight at the bridge, and they caught this poor man falling to his death, his suicide fall, two angles, man. And they tracked him coming off the bridge from below, and they tracked him coming off the bridge from above. I'm not saying anything about the filming. I'm not saying that these men in the least understood what was about to happen. But you got to understand something. The reason why they made this movie is they were drawn to film this horrible phenomenon taking place that year in San Francisco. There were more people jumping off the San Francisco Bridge that year than any other. Isn't that interesting? Than any other year that in history. Even though 2004 was actually we were still in kind of economic boom times, weren't we? I don't know. Steele interviewed relatives of the suicide victims, not informing them that he had footage of their loved ones' deaths. He claimed to ABC News that all the family members now at this point have seen the film and are glad that they had participated in it. Oh, my God, man.
So that guy had film footage of the people dying and he never said nothing? Man.
That's pretty weird, man.
I don't know. But I'll bet you anything, you got to do some pretty weird things, man, to make a movie like that, which was... You know, it's a goofy thing. It's just it's a very haunting thing. All right, I did want to mention this story about the Philip Morris CEO, and we're going to do that when we come back. He is the chief executive officer of Philip Morris. They are a tobacco company, like whoever the hell, man, all the other tobacco companies, you know, Brown and Williamson, and et cetera, et cetera. And the CEO of Philip Morris, Louis Camarelli, or excuse me, Louis Camilleri, says that it is easy to quit smoking cigarettes. We'll talk about that when we come back. World famous, never to be duplicated, never to be repeated, Phil Henry Show, except when we repeat it.
Phil Henry. For Patriots, by Patriots. It's the Phil Henry Show.
All right, welcome back here. And again, philhenryshow.com. Pick up a backstage pass and see a radio website with the largest archive. We have live streaming video every night. We have a five-day video archive. We have our daily podcasts of the show. We have classic podcasts of the show. We have our blogs. We have our comments section. And we have each other. That's philhenryshow.com, philhenryshow.com for your Phil Henry Show needs. Radio for Patriots by Patriots. Tonight, Philip Morris International CEO, Cigs, not that hard to quit. Yes, the head of cigarette maker Philip Morris International Incorporated told a cancer nurse on Wednesday that while cigarettes are harmful and addictive, it is not quite that hard to quit. CEO Louis C. Camilleri was in response to comments at his annual shareholder meeting in New York. Executives from the seller of Marlboro and other brands overseas spent most of the gathering sparring with members of anti-tobacco and other corporate accountability groups. The nurse, later identified as Elizabeth Gunderson from the University of California, San Fran, cited statistics that tobacco use kills more than 400,000 Americans and 5 million people worldwide each year. She's a member of the Nightingale Nurses, an activist group that works to focus public attention on the tobacco industry and how cool they look at night as they open windows and put sheets on patients. Now then.
No, I didn't say that.
Don't grab it from me, man. If it doesn't say it, I'll say I'm kidding.
You what?
I'm kidding. I'm joking around and Bud's grabbing it.
Look, let me see that. You kidding about what?
About the fact that the Nightingale Nurse Society is a bunch of women that think they look cool at night walking around opening windows.
Oh, is that what she did?
Yeah, that's what she did. No, she did a lot more than that. That was just the Florence Nightingale. You never heard of her?
Not really.
Florence Nightingale is a famous nurse. As a matter of fact,
I've heard of Florence Henderson.
Yeah, that's right. Florence Henderson, man. She was a really great nurse, and she pioneered the use of clean sheets. After, you know what? No, clean sheets and a very clean war. She was very big on clean, man. You might call her Mrs. Clean, you know.
Oh, she's the one that, they wouldn't have no infection on account of that.
Yeah, she was really big on keeping stuff clean. And she used to open up windows, get the air in, and jazz like that. All right, anyway, Elizabeth Gunderson. Gunderson also said a patient told her last week that of all the addictions he's beaten, crack, cocaine, meth, cigarettes have been the most difficult. Really? Crack, cocaine, and meth and cigarettes are the most difficult. That means, because I gave up cigarettes over a year ago, as you all know, that means that I should have at least experimented with crack, cocaine, and meth. I would have gotten off that stuff.
No, you're an idiot.
Oh. Anyway, in response, the often unapologetic Camilleri said, "We take our responsibility very seriously," he said, wagging a finger in the air and pointing at things. "And I don't think we get enough recognition for the efforts we make to ensure that there is effective worldwide regulation of a product that is harmful and that is addictive and that does make us rich. Yes, it's a $1 billion a year industry. It is addictive, but I'm doing what I can. But that's all that one man can do," he said, as he got into his Lincoln Continental that is chauffeured, yes, still, by a guy by the name of...
Got to drove Miss Daisy.
Right. Anyway, nevertheless, whilst it is addictive, it's not that hard to quit. This is what this clown's talking about. "There are more previous smokers in America today than current smokers. I bet you that makes you real happy there, Mr. Camilleri." Camilleri's a longtime smoker. An April 2009 Business Week article quoted him as saying he had quit only once for 3 months when he had a cold. Following Wednesday's meeting, the company reiterated its position that tobacco products are addictive and harmful. Matthew Myers, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said the comment represents the most irresponsible form of corporate doublespeak. Study after study has documented the powerful addiction to cigarettes as one of the most difficult to overcome of any drug anywhere in the world. It is stunning in the face of overwhelming science for the leader of the world's largest private tobacco company to deny how difficult and addictive cigarettes are. Now, at this particular point, folks, as you know, I am a former smoker, and I've also said that I would not become a former smoker with quotes around it, meaning a pain-in-the-ass, rude bastard, which many, many former smokers are. People who think they can walk up to total strangers. You know, one of these days, somebody's going to get a fist right through the face, out the back of their head, and they're going to wonder what happened with their big fat mouth and their, ooh, I don't like your smoke. Now, I want to say so. I'm sorry, I'm a former smoker, too, so don't talk to me about how I'm not defending the rights of smokers, but I am saying I know what it is to be a smoker. It is a very difficult thing to kick. I will tell you this much, though. I have to agree with the CEO of Philip Morris International, because all I needed, all Phil Hendry needed, was a little motivation. I didn't need a hospital bed. I didn't need detoxing. I didn't need somebody strapping me down to a gurney and pumping me full of Thorazine. So what are we talking about here, man? I happen to know that to kick the addiction of certain drugs, you need hospitalization. You need some form of detoxing, or you need some form of behavior control, external behavior control, to stay off of these drugs. Sometimes you have to quit work. Sometimes you have to go to a sanitarium or whatever the hell. Sometimes you got to, you know, really alter your lifestyle 180 degrees in order to kick a drug. Alcohol, there's one of the most dangerous drugs in the history of modern man. You want the most difficult drug to kick in the world, it's alcohol. Without question. As a matter of fact, I have heard it said, and I could be wrong, but I have heard it said that alcohol is the only drug the withdrawal from which can kill you. Can kill you. Withdrawing from heroin addiction, all of these other drugs we've been talking about, is difficult. You're sick, you don't feel well, etc., etc. You're not going to die. Booze, DTs, withdrawing from the effects of alcohol addiction, you can die. It's a brutal, dangerous, dangerous drug. Don't even worry about it. So when it comes to cigarettes, we got a different story. That's why I've got to agree with this clown. As much as he is kind of a doublespeak type of guy, and frankly, you know, look, dude, if you're in the tobacco selling business, you might as well be smoking that stuff yourself. If you're selling something that you know is harmful to the public and harmful to the consumer, and you're just selling it to them because they have a right to have it, I get it. But don't start talking to me about how you're responsible. You're an irresponsible ass. I mean, there's just no justification necessarily. Except for the following thing. There are addicts, they need it, and it isn't the kind of addiction that destroys necessarily our ability to produce, our ability to maintain law and order or families. Cigarettes are smoked by some of the finest people in the world. Cigarettes have been smoked by some of the most interesting people in the world. In fact, cigarettes are probably, if you want to find the most interesting and intelligent and creative people in the world, go find cigarette smokers. But Phil Hendry quit simply because he'd had pneumonia.
Yeah, that's why you quit.
Yeah. I didn't detox. I didn't go to any 12-step program. I didn't this. I didn't that. I wasn't munching carrot sticks. I wasn't doing celery sticks. I didn't do any of that jazz, man. I was laying up to a hospital bed. I wasn't smoking because I had an oxygen mask on, and I wasn't smoking because I had chest x-rays going every day, and I wasn't smoking because they wouldn't let me smoke in the hospital. And after I got out, I stopped, and that was it. That was the end of that. All I had to do was remember getting that nebulizer treatment, that gas they put into your lungs to clear them out from pneumonia. Okay, so I didn't alter anything, and I didn't have to be brainwashed, and I just didn't want to smoke anymore.
Yeah, but you'd smoked a long time too, man. How many years you smoked?
I quit at the age of 57, so I 14. What the hell is that? 43 years.
43 years, man. That boy,
Yeah, but you know what? That's a long time, and that's a lot of addiction, but it's one other thing. It is, I'm sick of it. I'm done with it. I don't want it anymore. I don't have to do it anymore. I can't use it no more. Forget it, man. And if it ain't going to be lung cancer, it'll be a heart attack. Screw it. But one of the things that here's what didn't work with me, and I'm just letting you know this. First of all, Joe Camel, that's a joke. When they talk about Joe Camel gets kids to smoke, that's an asinine statement because most kids smoke Marlboros. That ain't Joe Camel. You figure if Joe Camel worked, most kids would be smoking Joe Camel. But looking at rotted out lungs didn't bother me at all. Looking at a guy with a hole in his throat didn't bother me at all. Looking at some dude who had one lung didn't bother me at all. Listening to people talking about being in the hospital with lung cancer didn't bother me. None of that stuff bothered me at all. None of it. Even well into my 50s, it wasn't bugging me at all. None of that. The thing that got me to stop was simply, it was an enforced period of no smoking for at least a week while I was in the hospital with pneumonia. And I got out and I got home and I said, well, you know, as long as I'm off them, I'll just stay off of them. And the reason why it worked this time is because I remembered how hard it was to breathe, and I remembered how difficult it was for me just to get up and go to the can, man. I had to take that whole damn machine with me.
Yeah, are you talking about when you're in a bathroom? You're like, damn it. Well, I better not say.
Yeah, would you shut up, man, okay?
You want to talk about having to change underwear?
Change underwear? Well, you lousy. Talk about that later on, man. When I got up to go to the can, and you got pneumonia, you're hacking your guts up. You're coughing. You can't take two steps without hacking your lungs out. I mean, and the nurses, you know, I was right next to this nurse station. I guess they're used to hearing it, though.
Yeah, man, they probably hear it all the time.
I mean, I got up, and I remember thinking, oh, God, I got to go to the can, man. That means I got to get up. I got to drag this freaking machine with me that has all my bloody, you know, the needles that are in your arm, all that crap, man.
Yeah, like an IV drip and stuff?
Yeah. And on top of that, I'm like, every freaking four steps, man, I'm hacking my guts up. When I went to take a shower, I'm coughing my guts out. If I move 3 feet, I'm coughing my guts out. And I mean, you go through a week of that, you're like, well, forget it. I ain't going to do it anymore. There was also a period where it was probably like Wednesday or Thursday, you know, because I went in on a Saturday night. And I didn't think I'd get out of there. I mean, it's an irrational thought, but I remember laying there thinking, am I ever going to get out of this place? I got my son. I got Alex bringing me Pollo Loco, you know?
Yeah, you tell me about that food sucked, huh?
After a while, I hated that food. I mean, it's no offense to the hospital, but I guess hospital food just wears on you, man. By about Wednesday night, man, I'm calling Alex. I'm going, dude, you got to bring me some Pollo Loco, and you get me a 12-pack of Coke. I mean, I got to live. A man's got to live. So thank God for him. You know?
What did he bring you over, man? Like a family bucket?
What an idiot, man. Out of here. What did
he bring you?
He brought me the family. Yeah, he brought me the what do you mean, what did he bring me? Anyway, that was that. And so I got out. I said, I'm never going to be a reformed smoker when I get out. You know, I see somebody smoking. Go ahead, smoke. You know? The only thing that I ask now that's different from back in the day, people don't smoke in my house now, you know?
Well, that's kind of candy ass.
Why is that candy ass?
Well, you said you weren't going to change.
Yeah, what, do they get to smoke in your car?
No, they ain't going to smoke in my car either. In fact, I got a brand new car. Nobody's smoking in that car. But even when I smoked, I didn't want anybody smoking in my car.
Except you.
Yeah, except me. Which was ridiculous, if you think about it. All right, Phil Hendry Show here. And don't forget our website, philhendryshow.com. We got one more segment coming up after the show. Don't forget to check our website for our show log and other interesting features and factoids. The Ohio House approves a bill that allows weapons in bars. What could possibly go wrong? We'll check that out coming up on the Phil Hendry Show.
Radio for patriots by patriots. It's the Phil Hendry Show. Radio for patriots by patriots. It's the Phil Hendry Show.
All right, welcome back here on the world famous Phil Hendry Show. I got more stuff going on, man. What the hell are we doing next week, anyway?
Yeah, get the electrician come over to your house.
Yeah, well, man, why don't you get some light in the kitchen? That's the craziest thing I've ever seen. And you know what? All you're doing, man, you're going to burn the house down.
I'm getting it fixed next week. The lights went out in my kitchen. I had one of those fader switches, the fader that makes the lights go up and down. And it went out, and I've been, for like weeks now, I've got no lights in the kitchen at night. So, yeah, the electrician is coming next week. And we're finally going to get fixtures put up on the outside of the house because, you know, I had it painted last summer. But I thought, screw it, man. I ain't going to go through the whole winter and all that stuff. I'm going to wait till next summer and put the lights on the outside of the house so that stuff's happened. So there's a lot of stuff going on next week. I don't know, man. And then I got to go back in and do some looping for Napoleon Dynamite. And, you know, and here we are. We have lives and we have places to go and people to see. And we've got, you know, we're motivated to do things. And then there's some poor guy jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, that's pretty sad, man.
Do you ever talk to somebody that tried to kill himself?
Uh-oh.
I talked to someone once. I said to them the logical thing that I guess a lot of us would ask who would never do that, and because how do you get the guts? You know, in other words, aren't you afraid? And they responded with the most logical thing that I never even thought that they would respond with, but naturally they did, and it was no, it was going to be a relief.
They're going to be relieved they're dead.
Yeah. They're like, no, man, I was looking forward to it. After all the bull crap that I was living in, no. Like, so anyway, Ohio House approves bill to allow weapons in bars. Speaking of killing yourself, so long as you don't drink. So long as the guns don't drink.
What?
I'm joking. A divided Ohio House passed a bill today that would allow concealed carry permit holder to carry firearms into restaurants, bars, and open-air arenas that serve alcohol as long as they don't drink. Well, then why the hell are they going into the bar?
Yeah, that don't make no sense.
The whole reason why we're not expanding Second Amendment rights. We are restoring Second Amendment rights, said Representative Terry Johnson, a Republican from McDermott, one of the measure's sponsors. I agree with all of this, and I am not a gun nut, and I'm not a guy that just likes to shoot into the air and pretend I'm the Oklahoma kid. You know, it's just the logical result of coming to our senses about guns. It's the logical end result of this society finally, coming to its senses about guns, that guns are not the problem. Criminals are the problem. Psychopaths are the problem. Deranged individuals are the problem. The criminally motivated and compelled. This is the problem. A gun is not a magical instrument that causes people to act in evil ways. It's not a talisman. It's not some kind of mojo. It's a gun.
Yeah, but it's going to kill people.
Yeah, it's going to kill people. It's going to kill people if it's fired. And who's on the other end of the fire? Who's the guy? What's the hand that's holding the gun? If it's held by a cop, well, then it's a gun that kills bad guys. If it's held by a bad guy, then it's a gun that kills good people. If it's held by good people, then it's a gun that kills bad people. It depends on the people's what is holding it.
Understood.
Thank you. The bill passed 56-40 and now moves to the Senate, which has already passed a bill identical to that legislation. Today's bill would also loosen restrictions on how guns are carried in vehicles, allowing loaded weapons to be carried without being holstered or put in a case. So this open carry and things like that. Supporters argue the police cannot be everywhere and are often called too late to stop a murder. Well, this is old news. It's not old news, the brand new story. But this is the logical end result of too many years of Jack Ball saying that all we needed was gun control. That would have stopped John Hinckley. All we needed is gun control. That would have stopped Mark David Chapman. If there were no guns to be had at all, Mark David Chapman would have done what?
He never would have killed John Lennon.
Right. He never would have killed John Lennon. So, in other words, Mark David Chapman wouldn't have tried to get a gun illegally?
Well, he'd be afraid of getting arrested, wouldn't he?
He's going to kill a guy. Why would he be afraid of getting arrested for carrying a gun that he didn't get legally?
Oh.
John Hinckley wants to impress Jodie Foster. Do you think a gun law is going to stop a guy like that? He's got Jodie Foster, man. He wants to make sure he impresses her. All he has to do is meet some guy, God knows where, at a swap meet someplace behind a bar and grill. I don't know. Out of the trunk of the guy's car, he's got himself a gun. Three Republicans joined some Democrats in attendance and voting no. So this is the logical step as a society restores its sanity concerning guns. And as we've often mentioned on this show, it is one of the fallacies, among the many fallacies that guns are responsible for some of the most egregious and traumatic forms of or events of events containing violence or about violence in the history of our country. Bowling for Columbine is an interesting case in point. When Michael Moore made that movie, it was his point that it was guns that caused the tragedies at Columbine. As we've said many times on the show, they wanted to blow up Columbine. It wasn't guns. Those two clowns were intent on blowing that place up. As a matter of fact, those two guys were jihadists before we knew what a jihadist was. But Moore can't sell that. He doesn't know what that is. He's too stupid to even understand that in those pre-9/11 days. So he thought it was all about guns. And he made his jackass movie. And it didn't teach us a thing, except it got people standing out there at anti-gun rallies on the anniversary of Columbine. Way to miss the point. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show is produced by Jason Rantz. Technical director is John Elka, and our executive associate producer is Dan Northcraft. PhilHendryShow.com is the official right arm of the Phil Hendry Show. Visit us for HDTV archives, our podcasts, our blog, and all of our merchandise, man. We got the mugs, we got the shot glasses, we got the official Phil Hendry Show t-shirt, and of course all of our legacy CDs at PhilHendryShow.com.
Phil Hendry.